What have you, did you do, Bubba, so you read, which, what are you reading in Thompson?
I went back and started listening and making notes on, I heard, I'm going to switch real quick. It's interesting, that you, I saw that Transforming History is in Amazon, but you say it's the later release and it's missing some text?
Yeah, you want the 2001. Get the 2001.
Okay.
It has a, the first cover you see is 2009, and so you want to get the first different cover that shows up as you scroll down.
Okay. Yeah, thanks. Now, I went back and started listening to what you did on What Youth on the Third. And I found some interesting references. He's talking about this quote is a history of curriculum. A history curriculum is a mineralization, and it's a mineralization of one civilization and the transition to the next. The Irish
now,
monks.
What is that? A history? Did you say history?
A history curriculum. It's a quote from Thompson that you read.
Yeah.
It says a history curriculum is a miniaturization of one civilization and a transition to the next.
Yeah.
The Irish monks of the Dark Ages of Western Europe miniaturized Greco-Roman civilization into the curriculum of the classics and thus found a foundation for what would become the high civilization of medieval Western Europe. And so now it is necessary for us to miniaturize the civilization that we are leaving in preparation for the civilization that we are about to enter.
Yeah, we have to miniaturize the one we're leaving. And that's probably, that's another word for holopathic, you know, endless shrinking.
Yeah, because that was your quote afterwards. You said that that's what your chart attempts to outline.
So the miniaturization.
Yes.
Okay, so what about that quote, or did you just say it? It had connected to chart?
Yes. Go ahead.
Wait, what was miniaturized? What is today? See, I say the Android meme, it gets tinier and tinier, so it miniaturizes the analog media and then makes you seem to be king or queen of the analog media, which are actually a digital flow. So Ion then miniaturizes the Android meme to put it aside. Ion can go into any part of the Android meme.
Yeah, they are there. I mean,
yeah, it doesn't overwhelm Ion. So that's a good process, and then he got that from McLuhan in a way. That's a variation of McLuhan's every age turns the previous one into an art form. So he made it miniaturization. So it's a good pattern and ionic, or points to what Ion is doing.
Yes. What I enjoy with Thompson is his, he gives a lot of historical background. I mean, the historical
cultural
background.
Stuff.
Cultural background, which is interesting. But actually, LaRouche does the same thing on a different angle. I mean, he gives you some history, but he also presents it in sort of a radical way, but it's just it's kind of pleasing to the ear or just the mind when you read and hear Thompson. It's he's a guy, he's like, I think you and Carolyn talked about it, that he's a caring person, whereas if you compare him to Zappa or LaRouche, they're indifferent, but he kind of cares, but he's, I guess now he's quite jilted or bitter.
Yeah, now, I asked Ion, who was Thompson writing about? And do you remember what he said? No, who's he writing for? Who's Thompson writing for? He said his secretary. And it makes level. Thompson always, even when he formed a commune, he didn't like the big impersonal MIT that he taught at. You know, he's small, is beautiful. So he wanted to retrieve human scale and teach within that context. So he formed a commune and taught and then brought in other teachers like Bateson, and he really was trying to educate people around him, like the secretary. It's very accurate, and that's what you mean. He's nice. He can work on a local level. He's not trying to become president of the United States. You know what I mean? He's just dealing with who's around him, and it was that way in his seminar that we attended for years. And it was very personal, like this. I got that part of Thompson working with me here.
Yes.
I know your guys' lives relatively, and we address them, and we're not running for president. We're just declaring we already are president. And so that part of Thompson is what Carol and I naturally do.
Yes.
We're trying to enlighten our neighbor. You know, the secretary, the neighbor.
Yeah. Also, I found interesting just about Bateson, that he was married to Margaret Mead.
Yeah.
I never heard of Bateson, but I just found it interesting that he did a lot of the, did you say he started the mind control? Or he was the first researcher?
He was at Stanford or Palo Alto. In that era, whatever university did it, in the late 50s, he was running, and he was an accomplished anthropologist and everything by that point. He was part of the MACI conferences that created the cybernetics thing, which you can read about in the book, How We Became Post-Human. So the MACI conferences was the establishment CIA's MIT version of McLuhan seminars.
Mm.
And Margaret Mead and Bateson were married, and they were part of that. And then he went on, for some reason, to run the LSD tests in the late 50s that, if he was there, I know the Grateful Dead guy, Jerry Garcia, did it at that point, so maybe it was when Bateson was there.
Hmm.
But that's pretty, if that's true, that Bateson was part of that, and I read it in different places, then he was it's an odd thing to get involved in, you know, if you're a respected intellectual.
Yeah, just to switch back to Sarfatti, I remember reading that he had contact with Leary, but he never. There was just some references that Leary read some of his work and contacted him before he got out of prison, but he never really went into full depth. But you could tell that him and Leary had some type of interaction or engagement.
Right. Well, and Jack interacted with most people.
Okay.
I mean, on his list was Courtney Love's father, Harry somebody or something. And he was very estranged from Courtney and even sort of had the theory that Courtney killed Kurt Cobain. So
really?
Yeah, and you can Google him. I have to go, you know, Courtney's father, Harry somebody, and then you'll see interviews with him. He's quite a controversial person.
Hmm.
So Jack knew that world.
Yes.
Okay, so what you were just saying about Thompson, his wife.
They was nice. He was nice. He was nice. That's where the last subject was.
Everybody that LaRouche writes about, Thompson writes about. In this book, Transforming History, LaRouche's hero is Leibniz. Thompson comes up with how important Leibniz created the worldwide. What are you nodding at, Carol?
Yeah, I was just reading that today, Thompson on Leibniz.
And how Leibniz was the first worldwide web.
Yeah.
He corresponded with everybody. He was networking. Did you get that sentence, Carol?
Yeah.
That's what you read. And so he makes a big deal out of Leibniz like LaRouche does. They all talk about the same people, but it's twiddle-dum, twiddle-dee. They're looking at the opposite side. Everything that Thompson makes out of it is evil from LaRouche's point of view. And everything that LaRouche makes out of it, Thompson considers evil, or he wouldn't use the word evil, but it was deficient. They're really twins seeing the same thing from each side, the opposite side. It's amazing, same people. Like Bateson does MK Ultra, supposedly at Stanford, at Palo Alto, and the LSD. That's a bad thing in LaRouche world. But then Bateson goes on to be an associate and live at the commune in the 70s with Bill. So you can see Bill as, and Bill's very balanced. He apologizes, or he says, well, the British were assholes, but they offered this kind of moral order, blah, blah. He can always rationalize what everybody has done, good, bad, or indifferent, because he's detached, whereas LaRouche gets hysterical. So it's but the tetrad manager, the detached tetrad manager, is who can be kind of an evil guy. Thompson is more like that than LaRouche is.
Yes. It's
a really important historical dynamic that I have in my chart to pick those two guys. I mean, I would meet Thompson. Let me just say, meet in the Thompson group, meet people, bring up LaRouche. They never heard of LaRouche because they were lost in the Thompson wing. Then I talked to LaRouche people, and they wouldn't know Thompson. I was the only fucking guy who knew about the actual mirroring of each other going on. Yeah, go ahead.
No, it's just, I believe it was, correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought I heard you also reference Thompson was quoting some of the Aristotelian physics guys that LaRouche talked about also. I don't remember the name.
He tends to celebrate the bad guys. They know the history, they know the same names, and Thompson tends to go with the Aristotelian bad guys, and LaRouche goes with the other ones.
Yeah, I think it's Cassini. Cassini, one of the guys that were head guys that LaRouche talked about that started the Aristotelian move with the physics.
Well, no, not Cassini. Cassini is no such guy. It has to be Nicholas of Cusa. Is one guy, 1440, yes. Set up the Council of Florence. Then there's Pacioli, Da Vinci.
You're talking about the bad guys on the other side of them.
Oh, the bad guy. Oh, then that would be a Venetian, like Paolo Sarpi or Contini. Contini.
Contini, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, now Thompson. I've never seen Thompson mention Contini.
Okay, but I thought that there was a parallel there, just in hearing it when you
LaRouche gets pretty obscure with the Venetian guys. I don't think Thompson knows the Venetian guys.
Okay.
Just like Thompson knows obscure Aristotelians that LaRouche doesn't know.
Okay.
So they from their own angle know more than the other guys within their respective fields. But it's a great interplay. And then you have the interplay between McLuhan and Croker. That's an interesting replay.
McLuhan against Croker, or they go against each other in their views.
Wow. Because Croker goes through the Frankfurt School, who are evil from LaRouche's point of view, and sort of nihilists from Thompson's point of view. And so Croker hoiks up the media ecologists in the Marxist-derived world. Most of them McLuhan never heard of. And then McLuhan writes about people that Croker does not write about.
Mm-hmm.
But they come out of the same general field. So it's a very interesting, it's like that psychic Reverend Nagorka I played a few weeks ago. I had created a very interesting web, but what did he say that you sift your fingers through? The web of interpatterning. It's a really important history of the 20th century that's embedded in my my tiny note chart.
Yes.
I mean, when I was with Thompson, we'd go to this restaurant called the Symposium, like on East 116th Street, just up from the cathedral, and people would talk to him, and then he would start talking about George Bush the way LaRouche would talk about him. And he'd talk a little conspiracy stuff, which he never did much in public. And I was the only one who was able to feed on it and tell him more about it and develop it. The other people just would be dumbfounded. But Thompson could talk, and I saw that he thought about LaRouche. He even wrote a poem about him. He thought about these guys because he probably knew they were writing about him. He knew who he was competing with. And only I brought that out, or could bring it out, because the people in his New Age quadrant, they didn't think about that stuff. The top-down conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't even know that much about McLuhan.
Is Croker and Thompson aware of each other? Were they totally and totally different?
No, when I was doing the Fatty Communion book. What was your last sentence?
Are they in two different spheres that they're still in their own worlds that they don't really look outside them?
I don't think Thompson knows about Croker. Might know now, but not when I was talking to him 24 years ago when I was getting permission in late 91 to use quotes. I mean, I had to go to LaRouche organization, Thompson, Croker, And the McLuhan World, I just went to the publishers of all his books. And so I was getting the copyright permissions, and when I told Croker what the book was laid out, I told him that Thompson had never heard of him, and he goes, that's surprising. So for some ridiculous reason, Croker thought that Thompson should know about him, but I knew that, no, the Croker World was not in Thompson's framework. And I never brought up Croker with Thompson because he didn't know that much about it. Now you'll see a footnote in Transforming History where many years later, when Baudrillard became famous, Thompson started being accused of ripping off L.A. in that chart I did the other day: Paris, okay. New York, L.A. You know, 99, 2000. And he says, "What these people who accuse me of ripping off Baudrillard? They didn't. They'd be younger kids coming out of college who studied Baudrillard. And then Baudrillard's done a lot in Los Angeles, and so did Bill. These people, they maybe Generation X people, did not know that Thompson grew up in L.A. and his first book at the age of second book, but the one that didn't come out of his college research. That one was the Irish Rebellion, but." In 71, at the end of history, is all about L.A. as prophetic of what's coming. And he didn't write about it the way, the stylistic post-McLuhan way Baudrillard did, but he was on to the same point so that years later he could say, no, I did Baudrillard 20 years before Baudrillard, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Not exactly accurate, but he certainly was looking through the lens of McLuhan at what L.A. meant, and that's what Baudrillard did, so... He says, now I enjoy reading, his irreverent style of writing. He says, I enjoy Baudrillard. And he mentions Derrida, but he never talks about Deleuze and Guattari or Lyotard or Virilio. He might mention Foucault, but he doesn't know the extra guys. He doesn't see the 50 degrees, 50 kinds of snow in the postmodern world. And he says postmodernism basically... is the people who were talking about Baudrillard and them are people who write for the New York Review of Books, very intellectual, lefty kind of organ, or it was, and they're doing New Age ideas, but they put it through literary book concepts. So Thompson saw them as very aligned with New Age, but Croker wouldn't say that. He would knock the New Age as too monistic, too much in the monad. Anyways, I'm an expert in talking about the interplay of these guys because that's what I read and would meet and know their worlds and then put them in my chart.
Yeah. It's interesting to every time to read one of the guys, you can see the parallels. It's amazing what you just said about Thompson and LaRouche, but then you just added another view for me to consider is the interaction of Croker and McLuhan, which is something I didn't see, but it makes sense because of how they are always circulating and how they end up at your quadrant. The anthropomorphic physical is the interplay.
Yeah, of all of them, right?
All of them, yes.
So Croker's first book is on McLuhan, 1984. He's going to create a Canadian postmodern front against the French and everybody else. And so he picks Harold Innes, McLuhan, and George Grant, makes a Canadian statement in 84. Then in 86, he puts out the postmodern scene. That's got a lot of good stuff to read. I quote from a good chunks of that in the Croker part of my book.
Yes.
So Croker is very influenced by McLuhan, but in his Frankfurt Marxist world, you must put McLuhan down. You must say that he got lost. So Croker, through the late 80s, early 90s, even in that 1984 book, basically says McLuhan got ripped off by the corporate elite and not too relevant right now. And then he'll go into Baudrillard's more relevant. Then Croker will develop his own extra post-Baudrillard stuff. And he never would acknowledge McLuhan until about 4 years ago. He gave a press conference. Must have been maybe in the centennial 2011 year. He came out and made a big statement about McLuhan. You see, Northrop Frye, McLuhan's intellectual opponent in literary criticism, he wrote a book called The Educated Imagination. So Coker comes out and makes a press conference within the university context called The Miseducated Imagination. So he goes on about how McLuhan used miseducation, or my whole fallacy is wrong, to go beyond, go past Northrop Frye. So he always has a great, unique spin. Like he's come up with the dark tetrad in his newer books. You have the tetrad, and he's the only one who's come up with the, since the post-apocalyptic, postmodern world is under the negative sign, you have to redo McLuhan under the negative sign. So he has a negative version of the tetrad. I'll have to look it up sometime and read it to you.
Yeah.
So Coker is trying to get past McLuhan and has to, you know, really kind of erroneously diss McLuhan.
And he's using the Marxist socialist agenda, which means he's not going to like McLuhan being taken over by Madison Avenue.
Or the Catholic part. I think he says that because McLuhan was still believed in the Catholic stuff, he wasn't capable of really seeing through the Android meme or seeing it deeply or something. But the that's not really true. But Coker is... I know that George Sanderson was a good friend of McLuhan. He was a professor in a Catholic university in Nova Scotia who I knew a bit. And he became a confidant of the family, but he or someone else told me that he encountered Coker at some conference, say in the 80s, and he lambasted Coker, told me he was an ignorant idiot, and using McLuhan very badly. He pointed out somewhere that he, you know, scolded Coker because George would know enough about McLuhan that you couldn't play the uninformed games on George, and he found that whatever Coker was saying was, you know, McLuhan derivative, but all wrong. So he's the only guy I know in the McLuhan world of the old gang that, you know, chewed out Coker. Now, de Kerckhoff has known Coker for years, and they get along. And de Kerckhoff is a fly-by-nighter. He won't even talk about McLuhan. So Coker, here's de Kerckhoff running the McLuhan program, but he knows the Coker Frankfurt School postmodern guys are running academia. So Derek hangs out with them, gets invited to the Venice Biennale to speak. The art world, Coker world, Baudrillard world, Virilio world, he knows you can't talk about McLuhan there. And so he was able to become friends with them because he never brought up the fact he was director of the McLuhan program. Now, what happened when the anniversary happened, the centenary in 2011, a lot of people, even Coker showed up and was at one of the McLuhan conferences. A lot of people were forced to talk about McLuhan.
Wow.
And de Kerckhoff has been asked to speak all over the place since then. Like he actually can talk about McLuhan now. But I don't know if he does, but he is getting a lot of gigs.
He's probably springboarding off his set.
I wouldn't be surprised that gives him reminds him of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, to spark some new insight on him when you discuss him. Speaking of that,
Did you hear me an hour or so ago say
that
we're trying to organize? And he said, so Bob, what is this ION thing?
Well, I know. You know I think I know, Bob.
What?
Why he asked that. I know why he asked that because I re-listened to yesterday the first two sessions that you and Carolyn did on the hypothalamus and the heart and and the critique and the different
ions. Mentions the Kerckhoff, doesn't he? He mentions the Kerckhoff.
He mentions some personal things about de Kerckhoff in there.
Yeah.
He say, Derek, I didn't explain the ion. Ions is just displaying his knowledge of what doing. And
yeah.
So
yes,
that's probably why. What is this thing? What is this thing, ION? Because he's probably...
Well, remember, that whole thing, that topic that went from the heart to the hypothalamus, triggered by that young woman, professor woman, worked... That was in a book that she did with de Kerckhoff.
Yes.
So I've been waiting for her and Bruce Powell to complain to de Kerckhoff that you're talking to Bob, and we're not talking to Bob anymore. He was very rude. That ION guy was a total rude to Christiani or whatever her name is. You know what I mean? So yes. Derek Karkoff told me about a month ago he was in Barcelona. That's where they are. So I was getting ready any time for him saying, no, Bob, I'm not going to do any more with you. I've heard some bad things about you and Ion. I'm waiting for this them to get to tell their complaint to him, but it hasn't happened yet. But he did say
that's how he would do it. What's this about Ion?
Yeah, what does Ion say?
Yeah.
No, he heard from them about what happened. Yeah, he may have. Yeah. But here's the thing. He knows about Ion because when I was with him in Nice in August 2014 at his apartment, the first evening I sat on the couch with him and his partner and explained Ion. And the next day, in the morning, I'm near the kitchen, and he says, look at this, Bob. And the top of the garbage can goes up without anybody touching it. You know what I mean? It just is an automatic fucking something. And he goes, look. And it goes up, and he goes, Ion. He made the top go up, maybe because he had a remote control thing, Carolyn, in his hand. I couldn't see. But he made it to magically the tip of the garbage can to go up. But as he said it, as he did it, he goes, Ion. And I laughed. It was a good joke. He was pretending that Ion was lifting the can. That was his absorbing what had happened the night before when I was telling him about all the neat things we were doing with Ion. So that's where he first acknowledged Ion with a sense of humor. Right. No, but it was just magically lifting. But, yeah, if you're saying that he could be saying what's the sign thing, could be connected to that woman.
Yes.
Now, I about 2 months ago, all of a sudden I got a request from Dukirkov to be my Facebook friend. So I brought it up to him a few weeks later, and he didn't know anything about it. So I don't know what caused that. So he didn't have any conscious desire, because I suspected that I was posting whatever the good stuff I've been posting, like me talking to Don Thiel, and then people were telling me, hey, Bob's got a lot of interesting McLuhan-derived interests of yours to Kirchhoff on his Facebook. You should go listen to it or look at it. But he denied that he knew that he had become a Facebook friend. So,
that was the Android meme, Bob.
What was? What part?
The request for you to be friends with
Derek
was the end of,
Yeah, that was Ion doing that, forcing Derek to become aware of things. But the, what's next? Why are we on this topic? Oh, just about the interplay of Thompson, LaRouche, Coker, and McLuhan.
Yes, and Kirchhoff came on the end.
Yeah. So what's the next thing you've been looking into?
Well, I've been, like I said, I was just going through the What Youth you did on the 3rd, and I had another quote. Thompson does a good explanation about religion. There was one where at the end he says, the Son is one, but many are indifferent. The Son is one, but many indifferent are the flowers it brightens. How he uses
many indifferent. You got to read this correctly. He's using the word indifferent.
Okay. Indifferent. The sun is one, but many indifferent are the flowers it brightens.
Many indifferent.
Yep.
Oh, and D.
Yeah.
Many and different are the flowers it shines on.
I'm sorry. Here it is, Bob. I'll read it again. The sun is one, but many indifferent are the flowers it brightens. He was talking about the mind of religion.
Right, I know. So that's the book I just got. He writes for the Wild River Review. Been doing that for, I don't know, 10 years. And so he wrote a lot about religion. So they took his essays, and I read them on that blog. But now there's a little booklet. So I got it. So I can read you what he says. This probably you'd like this because it's called Beyond Religion. Hmm. And then the subtitles are The Cultural Evolution of the Sense of the Sacred. And another subtitle is From Shamanism to Religion to Post-Religious Spirituality. So obviously Ion would be in the category post-religious spirituality. It might even go further than that. So the first chapter is called Child Abuse in the Catholic Church. Second one is called From Shamanism to Religion. That would be going from tactile pre-literate cultures to literate cultures. from religion. Did you hear me do the displacement stuff? Maybe you didn't hear the series of displacements through history. You probably didn't hear that.
No.
I'll redo that for you a little bit. I'm not going to make it long. And then three, from religion to post-religious spirituality, one. Four, from religion to post-religious spirituality, two. From religion to post-religious spirituality, part two. Then the fifth section, our contemporary cultural evolution of spirituality, modern integral tantra yoga. And conclusion, so the sixth part, the end of the age of religion and the emergence of symbiotic consciousness. So you can see that New Age philosopher. You know, he's talking in the best way possible about what inspires the New Age counterculture, right? They ain't going to church, don't believe in that. Yes. Might do a little yoga, might do a little ayahuasca, might hear Ion and claim that they're fucking making reality and adopt Ionic dogma. You know, those different levels. So it's going to be an interesting book to read. Let's see. Let's go to the conclusion. What is his opening statement? Conclusion. Let's see. Maybe this is sort of short enough to read through. So the concluding paragraph. So I will tell you, listen to how this is the closest you could describe the role of Ion, but it's nowhere near what Ion actually is. So there's a lot of advanced avant-garde mystical assumptions in Thompson, but they don't go as far as Ion. All right?
Okay.
So he says, this is the conclusion, the end of the age of religion and the emergence of symbiotic consciousness. Through my collaboration with the chaos mathematician Ralph Abraham in designing an evolution of consciousness curriculum for the Ross School in East Hampton, New York. Now that's what you're reading. You're going to get the curriculum for the Ross School, okay? In Transforming History 2001. Through his collaboration with Ralph, I began to understand that the shift from the linear causation of Galilean dynamics, that's the 1500 to 1900, in the early modern era, to the complex dynamical systems of our era, this shift also expressed a shift from linear modernist ideologies and religions to planetary ecologies of consciousness in which diversity was affirmed. In the evolution of the catastrophe theory of the 1960s, with its images of saddles and butterfly folds, to the images of fractals and Lorentz attractors in the chaos dynamics of the 1980s, our cultural imaginary was given a gift of a new alphabet of symbols. So, chaos dynamics, catastrophe theory are modern symbols. Dynamical systems were given geometrical portraits of their behavior, and these were therefore called phase portraits. The linearity of left brain thinking was now to be balanced with a right brain activation. This emergence of a new visual mathematics expressed, in effect, a return on a higher turn of the spiral to hieroglyphic thinking. It all started with Poincaré, P-O-I-N-C-A-R-E, acute over the E. It all started with Poincaré in Paris in 1889 when he showed that the clean and consistent system of Kepler, that's Ruch's hero, in which the planets rotated around the sun in neat ellipses was not correct, that the solar system was actually a chaotic system. Now, LaRouche would take Poincaré's mathematics and show the error he made, because there's no way that LaRouche is going to give up on the importance of Kepler. You know what I mean? He's definitely not going to say he's a mistake. So there's fighting words right there for LaRouche. Then Thompson says, you can date the birth of complex dynamical systems, which come after the Galilean dynamical systems. So the complex dynamical systems are our time, the 20th century. So you can date the birth of them with Poincaré and say that the new era begins with his mathematical revisioning of the geometry of behavior of the solar system. At about this time, the pre-modernist esoteric cosmologies began to experience what Marshall McLuhan called cultural retrieval. So this is the new age in the 20s. And thinkers like Rudolf Steiner, 1920s, and thinkers, do that again. About this time, the pre-modernist esoteric cosmologies began to experience what Marshall called cultural retrieval, and cultural retrievals in quotes. And thinkers like Rudolf Steiner, Hazrat Inayat Khan, K-H-A-N, and William Butler Yeats began their visionary careers. The linear reductionism of modernism was going to be challenged by a cultural retrieval of animism on one side and a higher mathematics on the other. The composer Satie, Eric Satie, was a Rosicrucian, and the painters Kandinsky and Mondrian were theosophists. Clearly, complex dynamical systems began to impact on the cultural evolution of human spirituality. What could this new planetary culture possibly look like? First, egocentric monumentality and the extensive clutter of industrial civilization could be eliminated. That would be the miniaturization. We could shift from industrial object to ecological process. As foreshadowed in the living machines, that's in quote, living machines of the ecological designer John Todd. Some buildings, through the effectiveness of nanotechnologies, could become ephemeral and evanescent. That's a whole building becoming ephemeral and evanescent. Enduring structures could be more ecologically embedded in their setting, like the Shire of the Hobbits in the writings of Tolkien. Sentence before that. Enduring structures could be more ecologically embedded in their setting, like the Hobbit countryside. We could become electronic nomads who pitch their tent and pack them up and move on. Buildings could become appliances that we turn on with a switch and then turn off to make them disappear in the forest or meadow. And this would enable the human and animal domains to coexist more peaceably. Think of this as an electronic version of the Arthurian Lady of the Lake, you know, King Arthur, who used enchantment to keep her settlement hidden to mortals so that it appeared to the local inhabitants only as a lake. Our machines could become intimate and ensouled, have a soul put in them, by the elemental beings whose presence we might rediscover in the coming period of intense volcanic and tectonic activity. We will all have a chance to become animists again, like the present population of Iceland or the kahunas of Polynesia. I wonder if I should block something here. Okay. The kahunas, those people who have been living with volcanoes for some time. The kind of being that once was envisioned as ensouling a sacred mountain could now be seen to ensoul the noetic lattice of crystals in electronic and quantum computers in a new cultural imaginary in italics. As these computers, I'm going to mute everybody, Bert.
All participants are now muted.
As these computers are worn on in inner bodies and our body politic, our sense of in here and out there, those are in quotes, would be transformed as a cube became a tesseract or a sphere became a spiraling hypertorus in which the inside and outside surface are continuous through the spiraling axis. Our consciousness could become symbiotic as elementals become to us what mitochondria are to nucleated cells. But this symbiotic consciousness need not simply be restricted to human and elemental or animal realms. It could also be extended to involve the celestial intelligences. To imagine these software beings that are made out of music and mathematics, we need once again to go back to the end of the film 2001: A Space Odyssey, which I discussed with Arthur Clarke over breakfast in New York long ago in 1971, says Bill. When the astronaut approaches the monolith in orbit over Jupiter, he sees coming toward him rotating crystals of light and complex pulsing topologies. These are Stanley Kubrick's technological envisioning of what esoteric initiatives would recognize to be the Napoleonic celestial intelligences. The jinn, J-I-N-N, the jinn of the moon and the angels and archangels of the planets and stars. The celestial intelligences are like manifestations from non-physical. The jinn of the moon and the angels and archangels of the planets and stars. For Kubrick's and Clark's vision, however, it is these high-tech cosmic beings who serve as midwives to the astronaut's rebirth as he moves out of history into myth. To draw a circle, one moves from the point to the line. To draw a sphere, one pulls the circle up into the third dimension. To create a hypersphere, one rotates the sphere into the fourth dimension. One rotates a sphere into the fourth dimension. Our physical body, or what the yogis call our food sheath, has three dimensions. Just a minute, Carolyn's putting something down. Okay. Our physical body, or what the yogis call our food sheath, has three dimensions. But our other bodies, or sheaths, have more dimensions. And it is in the facets of the topology of these dimensions that the celestial intelligences can interfere with us and participate in the field of our consciousness. See how even he brings in multiple bodies. The brain may be a three-dimensional volume, but neurons in separate parts of the brain can fire together in the neural synchrony at the age of 40 hertz, at the range of 40 hertz. The geometry of the synchronies, engage as facets of the higher dimensional geometries of the subtle bodies, where both the Dalai Lama and Rudolf Steiner, the founder of Anthroposophy, say memory is stored. So the play of consciousness could not simply be reduced to a section of the brain. Cultures have in the past called this process of consciousness imagination. Cultures have in the past called this process of consciousness imagination or intuition. But whatever one calls it, it is basic to the creative process in art, science, and spiritual contemplative practice. So he's not even saying yoga anymore, let alone us. Mediating between the elemental, so he's like Ion bringing in the fairies and vampires and all that. Thompson includes that. Mediating between the elemental and human on one polarity and the celestial intelligences on the other is the realm of the soul. The soul, which for men is often figured as a feminine being, a Tara or Beatrice. In brackets, Jung maintained fire. Looking at something here, thinking about something. So, mediating between the elemental and human on one polarity and the celestial intelligence on the other is the realm of the soul, which for men is often figured as a feminine being, a Tara or Beatrice. In brackets, Jung maintained that for women, this contrasexual animus in quotes, was made. And then cites the Christ of St. Teresa of Avila or the Krishna of Mirabai. Jung maintained that for women, this contrasexual animus was male. So this realm of the soul was male. This being appears regularly in the intermediate life of our dreams. And here one needs to understand that dreams, as Sri Aurobindo pointed out for his generation, are very muddled memories of higher spiritual experiences, blended with the proprial perceptions of the physical body and the brain's return to waking consciousness. Let me read that again. As Sri Aurobindo pointed out for his generation, the very muddled memories of higher spiritual experiences blended with the proprial perceptions of the physical body and the brain's return to waking consciousness. As the spirit returns to the confinements of incarnation, it can start to dream it is in a conference or a crowded airport, and begin to dream that is as the spirit returns to the confinements of incarnation, it can start to dream it is in a conference or a crowded airport, and as it becomes aware of the body's full bladder, it will begin to dream that it is looking for the restroom in the airport. To interpret these dreams with Freudian or Jungian symbolic systems is at this level a category mistake. The imagery is taken from personal memory and is being used as metaphors for the reactivation of specific brain modules that are operative in the cognitive functions of the waking mind. Reading that again. The imagery... No. Get the previous. So, to interpret these dreams with Freudian or Jungian symbolic systems is at this level a category mistake. The imagery is taken from personal memory and is being used as metaphors for the reactivation of specific brain modules that are operative in the cognitive functions of the waking mind. Sounds a bit Ionic in the dismissal of using your dreams as a guide. I think that's what Ina said. Shamanism was the form of spirituality that evolved in the oral culture of pre-literate societies. Religion as a category, was the form of spirituality that emerged with literate societies and their new temple-based readings of the stars and the sacred texts. All right, we're going to get back to this. Just a second. Where were we? So, rereading the last bit. As these computers are worn on and in our bodies and our body politic, our sense of in here, in quotes, and out there, in quotes, would be transformed as a cube became a tesseract or a sphere became a spiraling hyper-torus in which the inside and outside surface are continuous to the spiraling axis. Our consciousness could become symbiotic as elementals become to us what mitochondria are to nucleated cells. But this symbiotic consciousness need not simply be restricted to human and elemental or animal realms. It could also be extended to involve the celestial intelligences. To imagine these software beings that are made out of music and mathematics. No, he's telling you. To imagine these software beings that are made out of music and individual software. And into... But this, I have to do it again. Our consciousness could become symbiotic as elementals become to us what mitochondria are to nucleated cells. But this symbiotic consciousness need not simply be restricted to human and elemental or animal realms. It could also be extended to involve the celestial intelligences. To imagine these software beings that are made out of music and mathematics, we need them. We need, once again, to go back to the end of the film, 2001 A Space Odyssey, which I discussed with Arthur Clarke over breakfast in New York long ago in 1971. Arthur Clarke over breakfast in New York long ago. So he sees this film, and then he has in brackets, which I discussed with Arthur C. Clarke over breakfast in New York long ago in 1971. So I guess, see, they talked about the movie. And he'd be a good guy, Joseph Campbell would be a good guy to talk to because he'd have this encyclopedic knowledge of all the plants and herbs that the local groups used. A Space Odyssey, which I discussed with Arthur C. Clarke over breakfast in New York long ago in 1971. What the hell? I read that wrong. To imagine these software beings that are made out of music and mathematics, we need once again to go back to the end of the film, 2001, A Space Odyssey, in brackets, which I discussed with Arthur Clarke over breakfast in New York long ago in 1971. When the astronaut approaches the monolith in orbit over Jupiter, he sees coming toward him rotating crystals of light and complex pulsing topologies. These are Stanley Kubrick's technological envisioning of what esoteric initiates would recognize to be the Neoplatonic celestial intelligence in quotes, the jinn of the moon and the angels and archangels of the planets and stars. What the fuck? I already read that. So.
What are you doing?
Wait a minute.
Where am I?
Yeah. The pages are loose. Oh, well. I'm going to have to read it again and get to the new part. So the celestial intelligence, the jinn of the moon and the angels and archangels of the planets and stars. For Kubrick's and Clark's vision, however, it is these high-tech cosmic beings who serve as midwives to the astronaut's rebirth as he moves out of history into myth. I didn't read that before, did I? Yeah. To draw a circle, one moves from the point to the line. To draw a sphere, one pulls the circle up into the third dimension. To create a hypersphere, one rotates the sphere into the fourth dimension. Our physical body, or what the yogis call our food sheath, has three dimensions. But our other bodies or sheaths have more dimensions, and it is in the facets of the topology of these dimensions that the celestial intelligences can interface with us and participate in the field of our consciousness. I didn't read that before, did I? Our physical body, or what the yogis call our food sheath, has three dimensions, but our other bodies or sheaths have more dimensions, and it is in the facets of the topology of these dimensions that the celestial intelligences can interface with us and participate in the field of our consciousness. So that's a predictive ion within a certain New Age language. If people think I am some kind of something, you know, fourth celestial intelligence, I don't think it would describe itself that way. So he's predicting how ion interfaces with us, his projection of ion. The brain may be a three-dimensional volume, but neurons in separate parts of the brain can fire together in the neural synchrony of the range of 40 hertz. The geometry of the synchronies engage as facets of the higher dimensional geometries of the subtle bodies, where both the Dalai Lama and Rudolf Steiner say memory is stored. So the play of consciousness should not simply be reduced to a section of the brain. Cultures have in the past called this process of consciousness imagination or intuition, but whatever one calls it is basic to the creative process in art, science, and spiritual contemplative practice. Now, LaRouche would say, yes, there's a common creative process for art and science, but he wouldn't add on spiritual contemplative practice. That would be faulty Aristotelian sense embedment. Mediating between the elemental and human on one polarity and the celestial intelligence on the other polarity is the realm of the soul, which for men is often figured as a feminine being. This is where we did this. A feminine being, Terra or Beatrice. Jung maintained that for women this contrasexual animus was male, the Christ of St. Teresa of Avila or the Krishna of Mirabai. This being appears regularly in the intermediate life of our dreams. And here one needs to understand that dreams, as Sri Aurobindo pointed out first generation, are very muddled memories of higher spiritual experiences blended with the proprioceptive perceptions of the physical body and the brain's return to waking consciousness. Go read that again. This being, so the being is celestial intelligence. Then he quotes Jung. So this being appears regularly in the intermediate life of our dreams. And here one needs to understand that dreams, as Sri Aurobindo pointed out for his generation, are very muddled memories of higher spiritual experiences blended with the proprioceptions of the physical body and the brain's return to wax consciousness. When the brain's return, sorry. As Sri Aurobindo pointed out for his generation, dreams.
What on earth are you reading and why are you reading it?
This is Thompson's conclusion. That's going.
A conclusion is supposed to be one paragraph. You've been reading for 10 hours.
Yes, sorry, but you're going to have to hear it.
You're making mistakes and going back and forth, there's no train of thought
that's good.
You can follow.
No, you can't understand when I first read it. You have to have it reheard so I make mistakes so I can redo it. You can't concentrate because you're doing stretching your ankles or something. All right. As Sri Aurobindo pointed out for his generation, dreams are very muddled memories of higher spiritual experiences.
Life is muddled.
Blended with the...
Life with Bob is muddled.
Blended with the proprio perceptions. So dreams are very muddled memories of higher spiritual experiences blended with the proprio perceptions of the physical body and the brain's return to waking consciousness. I don't know why I saw waxing consciousness. As the spirit returns to the confinements of incarnation, it can start to dream it is in a conference or a crowded airport. And as it becomes aware of the body's full bladder, it will begin to dream that it is looking for the restroom in the airport. To interpret these dreams with Freudian or Jungian symbolic systems is at this level a category mistake.
You read that 10 minutes ago.
So what? The imagery is taken from personal memory and is being used as metaphors for the reactivation of specific brain modules that are operative in the cognitive functions of the waking mind. I'm doing sampling. You know how modern music, they just go play this and play something else and then they go back and replay it? I am sampling. All right. The imagery is taken from personal memory and is being used as metaphors for the reactivation of specific brain modules that are operative in the cognitive functions of the waking mind. Shamanism was the form of spirituality that evolved in the oral culture of pre-literate societies. Religion was the form of spirituality that emerged with literate societies and the new temple-based readings of the stars and sacred texts. Though traditionalists may wish time to stop, it does go on, and now in our global electronic society, a new trans-religious form of spirituality is emerging, trans-religious, Carolyn, one that will not replace religions, any more than the nucleus of the cell replace the mitochondria, but will envelop them, go around them, in a much vaster form of consciousness. In this futuristic ontology, we are already beginning to glimpse an evolutionary entelechy. That's E-N-T-E-L-E-C-H-Y. From an exoteric, as opposed to esoteric, from an exoteric, or mainstream awareness, from an exoteric perspective, this entelechy is an ecology of cognitive domains, technological and biological. So that's sort of getting into our quote. From an exoteric perspective, this entelechy is an ecology of cognitive domains, technological and biological. This embeddedness of computerized technologies in the biological realm of the flesh is, quote, the age of spiritual machines, unquote, that the MIT computer scientist Ray Kurzweil envisions as our new culture in 2029. From an esoteric perspective, this new symbiotic consciousness of human, elemental, psychic, and celestial intelligences would express a turn on the spiral and a cultural retrieval of animism. See, this is ionic, right, Carolyn? Can you follow that? Are you listening close enough? The literal description of ion stuff. You're not listening properly, right? I will reread it for you. Yes, a couple of times. In the smuggled esotericism of children's literature, comic books, and science fiction, an archetypal group of four becoming one is being foreshadowed. For example, we see this grouping expressed in the Fantastic Four comics book and the four in the Wonderful Wizard of Oz. Dorothy, the Lion, the Tin Man, and the Scarecrow. So, reading that again, Carolyn. From an exoteric perspective, the outer kingdom, this entelechy is an ecology of cognitive domains, technological and biological. This embeddedness of computerized technologies in the biological realm of the flesh is the age of spiritual machines that the MIT computer scientist Ray Kurzweil envisions as our new culture in 2029. From an esoteric perspective, more secretive perspective, this new symbiotic consciousness of human, elemental, psychic, and celestial intelligences would express a turn on the spiral in a cultural retrieval of animism. You get that, Carolyn? In the smuggled esotericism of children's literature, comic books, and science fiction, an archetypal group of four becoming one is being foreshadowed. It's like my chart, eh? Four quadrants becoming Dobbs. For example, we see this grouping expressed in the Fantastic Four and the four people or things in the wonderful, he just says, and the four in the Wonderful Wizard of Oz. Dorothy, the Lion, the Tin Man, and the Scarecrow. So we're coming into the final part, Carolyn. In pre-industrial animist cultures, the human would establish a place for the elementals to cohabit or participate in its human life through the intermediary use of a magical object, a magical ring or stone, an Aladdin's lamp, or an ensouled sword such as Roland's Durandal or Charlemagne's Montjoy swords. Like the needles used in acupuncture, this numinous object can interact with its possessor at the subtle physical or etheric level, the level of ki or chi or prana. See? Ionic interaction with things, right? Like interacting with your eye cells. In shamanistic cultures, the individual would project out of his or her body and travel in a spiritual or astral world. If one is able through meditation to remain watchfully awake in the state of deep dreamless sleep, then one experiences a vast magenta sea of cognitive bliss in which one hears the music of everything. Remember, these terms express a merely Euclidean geometry. In the psychic realm of dreams or astral out-of-the-body travel, this is the world of the Holy Spirit that is above or below, remember those terms express a merely Euclidean geometry, above or below the psychic realm of dreams or astral out-of-the-body travel. In the astral, one travels, but in the realm of celestial music, the center is everywhere, acoustic space, I would add, the center is everywhere and the circumference nowhere, so there's no need to move. One simply joins in this hallelujah chorus to the nth power by listening and sounding one's ontic note, O-N-T-I-C. In this sense, music is not representational art. In this sense, music is not a representational art of mimesis, but an ontological performance. In this sense, music is not a representational art of mimesis, but an ontological performance. The human is the ordinary ego in time, but in the completion of our emergent evolutionary spiritual process, the ego becomes transhuman, anointed in quotes, or Christic. For esoteric Christians, the prophet Jesus became the Christ at the time of the baptism by John. And this narrative of the Son of Man describes the process of enlightened individuation. For Buddhists, this process seemed more like a wave. For Buddhists, this process seemed more like a wave than a particle, one in which egohood is transformed in dependent co-origination of enlightened Buddha mind. Not sure what he's... is he qualifying there? The prana? Just a minute, we're coming up to the finish here. For Buddhists, I read this last section again. The human is the ordinary ego in time, but in the completion of our emergent evolutionary spiritual process, the ego becomes transhuman, anointed, or Christic. For esoteric Christians, the prophet Jesus became the Christ at the time of the baptism by John, and this narrative of the Son of Man describes the process of enlightened individuation. For Buddhists, this process is seen more like a wave than a particle, one in which egohood is transformed in dependent co-origination of enlightened Buddha mind. Now, you may have noticed that one thing, says Thompson, that results from this ontology of symbiotic consciousness is a non-locality in which out there is in here, so that it is no longer necessary to put three-dimensional bodies in expensive tin cans and spacesuits and try to propel them to the stars. We may be able to go to the moon, and my Lindisfarne colleague, James Lovelock's, has proposed an atmospheric and bacterial greening of Mars. That's in quotes, greening of Mars. And such a project would certainly be a worthy effort towards sublimating the nation's defense industries into a transnational technological project with Europe, Russia, Japan, and China. However, I think it is highly unlikely that humans could travel in physical bodies to the stars. Indeed, that is precisely what the astronaut of 2001 discovers in his transformation from technological man to star child. So the Christian fundamentalist notion that we can trash the earth and move on, and that whatever mess we make here is permitted because Jesus will play the role of a suburban bum coming at an end. Because Jesus will play the role of a suburban mum coming in at the end of the day to clean up our room for us and then take us away in a vacation rapture to some theme park heaven, that is an expression of folk superstition and the limited three-dimensional thinking of religion. Reading that again. So the Christian fundamentalist notion that we can trash the earth and move on, and that whatever mess we make here is permitted because Jesus will play the role of a suburban mum coming in at the end of the day to clean up our room for us and then take us away in a vacation rapture to some theme park heaven is an expression of folk superstition and the limited three-dimensional thinking of religion. Jean Gebser taught us that when a new evolutionary form becomes efficient, the old becomes deficient. When religion emerged, shamanism decayed into sorcery and black magic. Now that a new planetary spirituality is emerging, religion has become a toxic dump, as witnessed in the recent terrorist attacks around the world. But the religionists, I mean the fundamentalists, are right in one way. The religionists. It is the end of their world. But the religionists are right in one way. It is the end of their world, but it also means the end of the age of religion and the beginning of unique/universal self-similar architecture of consciousness that is based upon individual experience and not upon priestcraft, rigid dogma, and collective forceful indoctrination. If we can avoid the dark age of religion that now stares us in the face, we may discover a more surprising and delightful politics of being behind the mask. You get that, Carolyn? You're not listening?
You're driving me to sleep.
All right. John Gebser taught us that when a new evolutionary form becomes efficient, the old becomes deficient. When religion emerged, shamanism decayed into sorcery and black magic. That's when visual space came in. That's writing in the alphabet. Now that a new planetary spirituality is emerging, religion has become a toxic dump. as witnessed in the recent terrorist attacks around the world. But the religionists, or fundamentalists, are right in one way, Carol. This is the way they're right. It is the end of their world. You know, it's the end times. But that also means the end of the age of religion and the beginning of a unique, universal, self-similar architecture of consciousness that is based upon individual experience and not upon priestcraft, rigid dogma, and collective forceful indoctrination. If we can avoid the dark age of religion that now stares us in the face, we may discover a more surprising and delightful politics of being behind the mask. So that's a nice introduction to Iyendhem, and then you find Iyendhem does a lot differently than he's projecting. So I will now unmute.
All participants are now unmuted.
Who's to come in? Fine. Fine reading.
Yes. I mean, it's good to do the repeat, because each time that you repeat, I heard something different, Bob.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he does.
Go ahead. He does.
No, he does give a what you call a textbook description of Iyendhem, but that's he's using words, so it's limited to what Iyendhem is, and
but
plus he's not offering a solution.
He's not what?
Offering a solution, actually, or a context to actually achieve that. He's stating it, laying it out.
Yeah, that there's a solution or some kind of drama, or maybe not a solution, but an emergent changing state is coming. That's what he says. And then he describes what is coming as best as words could do it. And we know Iyendhem is a process beyond what he's saying. But it's about the best you can get. Oh, yeah, because he collages fairies.
Yeah.
Magical stuff, hyper technologies, media. It's his collage, like my tiny note chart, that is relevant to what Iyendhem is.
Yes. And he used a lot of the words that Iyendhem has covered since they've been. I mean, he talked about crystals, wave particle cells, mitochondria, and he talked about the fairies, celestial consciousness. He talked all of that. I mean, he's covered all that Iyendhem has covered.
That's right. Celestial intelligences.